From the Moen Broadcast Center, it's Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The LA Unified School District's considering a rating system for its district-run schools as well as charters. It would provide parents with a way of comparing one campus against another. But are the criteria being considered really the right ones to use to give parents that sense of what's best for their kids? We'll talk about it coming up right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope your day's off to a strong start. Coming up in our second hour, we'll spend the entire time with Phil Washington, the CEO of LA Metro. When he joins us, we always hear from many listeners who have questions for him about the state of public transit, whether it's bus lines, light rail, or future construction plans for Metro, even the development business they've gotten into with transit-centric projects. We'll talk about all of that coming up in our next hour. So think of those questions that you want to ask Phil Washington as we get closer. But we begin with a story reported by Howard Bloom in the Los Angeles Times that the LA Unified School District is considering a rating scale for public schools as well as the privately run charters that are under the authority of the LA Unified School District. It would score each of the campuses on different criteria. The intent would be to give parents more information to help them decide which campus is best for their kids. Joining us, KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Good morning, Kyle.
Morning, Larry.
So is this something, to your knowledge, been in the works for a while by the district?
This has definitely been in the works for a long time by the district. In fact, the school board, before Superintendent Austin Buettner was hired back in April of 2018, passed a resolution to basically say this is a priority of us, of the school district, to have a rating scale in place. Now, the school board was a very different, kind of group of people at that time. It still included, you know, folks like Ref Rodriguez and a board majority that was backed by the Charter Schools Association. And generally, I think, you know, beyond whatever they feel about charter schools, I think we're more inclined toward ideas like this of having a more summative rating about what the school district, about how well schools are doing. They're sort of that school of thought that you know, quote unquote, education reform is sort of the label that you can apply to the school of thought behind this idea that they set in motion as early as April of 2018.
And would this involve, to your knowledge, a single numeric score that a campus would get, or is this all to be determined?
Well, I'm looking at what Howard Bloom reported in the LA Times, and there are some documents that are also publicly available, you know, outside of the LA Times. And so they're essentially the way that this all works is the crux of what Howard's story is in the LA Times. And the technicalities of this are detailed in some presentations you can find. The essential way that it would work is that schools would be essentially ranked by their test score growth, the growth of their test scores. We can talk about what that means in a second, by the absolute test scores. So and also by some school climate measures. So it's your test scores, like your straight up how many students passed the test or did not. Then a more complex measure of how well students improved or did not improve or regressed on those tests. And even that, it's more complicated than just, you know, a straight up, you know, look at the, you know, the pass rate last year and the pass rate this year and, you know, calculate the difference between the two. There's talk of breaking out the growth scores into different subgroups of students like English learners, low-income students, foster youth, doing it by ethnicity as well. So that's a very complicated metric, and I don't want to overstate my knowledge of how that metric is going to work, as well as measures like suspension rates and chronic absenteeism. Those would go into a ranking that would eventually end up with some sort of summative overall, kind of scale. The Times reports it as a 1 through 5 scale. There's been talk about a 5-star scale for these schools. And so it's what the story is about in the LA Times is the technicalities of how this all works. And it is all technical. I've done a lot of reporting on this. It's very difficult work.
Well, and to also give a parent a sense of his or her individual child's fit with a school. That's the difficulty. If you have a child with special needs, for example, doesn't necessarily matter what the overall performance of the school is how does the school do with the population that's most like your student who would be attending that campus? Or if you're a parent of a gifted child, what is the gifted, you know, what is the results that you see, or what do students and parents say about that? And you know, I think one of the problems with all this, it's such a blunt instrument. It doesn't necessarily tell you about how your kid's going to do there.
And that's absolutely a fair, you know, argument to make about these sort of systems. On the other hand, you have to think about the broader context that this is taking place in, where the state recently inaugurated the California School Dashboard, which tried to be the opposite of the blunt instrument, try and democratize all of the school's data so that you can go on to the state website and you can look at, you know, different breakdowns of how well the school scores related to test scores and how they do related to school climate measures like suspensions, for instance. And there's a whole color rating scale there. And I think what the argument that could be made about that and has been made by a lot of people who support something a little bit easier to understand is that it is too difficult to understand, that there's too much information, that it doesn't come up with a clear mechanism of saying this school is doing well or this school is not doing well. So this is a perennial problem with school rating systems. This has been tried in earnest for decades now at this point, at least since the No Child Left Behind era inaugurated, sort of high stakes ratings for schools. And the entire time, the tension has been between how detailed, technical, sort of, you know, holistic do you make the measurement without making it too difficult to understand.
And how you interpreted the suspension thing is fascinating, because unless you have a child who's apt to be disruptive in class, you don't necessarily care what the suspension rate is, unless you've got a kid who's on the cusp of suspension. If you're a parent, you may be thinking, well, gosh, it has a very low suspension rate. Does that mean that there's disruption in class that doesn't go, you know, discipline where? So again, that would be useful if you have a child that you know could be disruptive in class. You want to keep your child in school and have measures short of suspension. That could be an important metric to use, but not necessarily interpreted by other parents in the same way. I'd love to hear your thoughts as an AirTalk listener. What do you think about trying to score schools in an objective way so that parents have better sources of comparison in choosing one campus over another? I'm also interested in what you think should be the ways that schools are judged. For example, if you're looking at a school for your kid, does the upward trajectory of test scores matter as much as what the test scores are right now? Under at least what these documents Howard Bloom discloses show is that more weight is given to upward trajectory than to current test scores. Would you rate that similarly as a parent, or would you put more weight on current test scores? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also, in this week before school starts in LA Unified, I'd love to hear from those of you that are teachers. How do you think your school should be judged? Are there objective criteria that could be effectively used to judge how well your school is doing? 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us, LA Unified School District Board of Education member Kelly Gonez. Ms. Gonez, thank you for being with us. How far along is this process?
Thanks for having me. There have been conversations since the board passed the resolution in April of 2018 with a collaborative and diverse group of stakeholders who met many times over that year. And it's my understanding that staff are still working through some questions about the metrics, because as you and Kyle discussed, there are a lot of complications and technicalities in trying to create a system that is fair and that's also understandable to the public. So my sense is that they're still working through some of those issues, and we will get a better sense of that timeline as to when a system would be relatively complete later in the fall.
And does UTLA, the teachers union, have significant input on developing this system?
Members of UTLA, as well as our other bargaining units, were a part of that working group that met as a result of the resolution for all of last year. So there were members of our labor partners who were represented in that room, as well as educators, administrators, parents, and district staff. So they did have a voice, and I imagine as we get closer to creating a system, we will continue to have conversations with all of our stakeholders to make sure we're getting their feedback at every step of the process.
And beyond putting a numeric rating for campus, are there ways that prospective parents can dig deeper into the data? Because it would seem to me if there's a way the district can set up an even deeper dive beyond a top line score, that might be of value to parents to be able to go through and look at some of the other performance aspects of a campus.
So I think the idea is that while there might be some sort of overall sense of how a school is doing as part of the school performance framework, that there would be a way to break out some of these composite measures. So to get a sense on socio-emotionally, how are students doing, to get a sense academically, how are students are doing, what is the school climate like? And I think ideally, eventually, also include things like feedback, surveys from parents and staff about how they feel about the school would be included in that system. But I do, Larry, just want to push back a little bit about the framing. This isn't, if you read the resolution, it's about a focus on continuous improvement. How do we help ensure that all of our schools are getting better? Of course, part of that is making sure that parents and our community members have a good and transparent sense of how schools are doing and how they can support that work of continuous improvement. But it's also about putting the onus on ourselves as district leaders, making sure that we are sending supports and resources to where they are most needed, and that we are focusing on our schools that most need support. I don't think that has historically been the case. We know that oftentimes schools have struggled, and the resources and supports may often be determined by how loud a particular community or parents are about what they need. And that, unfortunately, historically has negatively impacted sometimes communities of color and low-income communities who aren't getting the same supports and resources, even though we know their children have needs. And so I think this is also about guiding the district's decisions to make sure that we are holding ourselves as leaders accountable to make sure that we are helping our schools most in need and helping those students and the teachers and principals working hard in those schools get the supports and resources they need to best
right.
students.
We're talking with Kelly Gonez, LA Unified School District Board of Education member. You'd mentioned some of the objective ways of measurement, what parents think of the teaching staff or administration of their local school. And I'm just wondering how systematized is that? Can a prospective parent look and see what students and students and parents think about a teaching staff or administration at each school of the district? That kind of survey result widely available.
Again, to correct you, because I think it's important to be precise here. It's not parents aren't giving feedback about particular teachers or principals. That's not objective, could be biased, and not at all something that we would want to make public and that we would include in this. We currently have throughout the school district an annual school experience survey that parents as well as students and staff all complete. And parents, staff, and students are giving us feedback through that survey at all campuses on things like how safe do you feel at your school? How happy do you feel at your school? Do you feel like you have a positive relationship with an adult, with your peers? And then staff can also give feedback on their feelings of safety and belonging at a school. So we think that an instrument like a survey, which we already have, as I said, we're already administering that district-wide, could help us get a better sense of some of those intangibles, which we know can't be quantified with things like a test score, but we know are also important in terms of how you evaluate the quality of a school.
Well, and I understand what you're saying, that you wouldn't want to be publicly releasing what students and parents think about a specific teacher, but couldn't you have public release for a campus generally what students and parents think of the performance of the teaching staff and administration? Would that be a problem to release that?
I think that that could have some serious unintended consequences. And I think, again, we have to think about what's the purpose, right? The purpose is to make sure that all schools are serving children well. The purpose is not to be punitive and to place blame or as you know, you all were talking about, to be a blunt instrument that is harmful to, again, teachers and principals who are working hard on the ground every day to support kids. The goal is for us as a district and also for the broader community to have a sense of how our schools are doing and how we can make sure that all schools are helping kids be prepared for college, career, and life. I think that's why we would want to focus on the more quantitative measures when we think about academic performance, like our English learner reclassification rates, like graduation rates. But when we think about things like socio-emotional belonging, when we think about safety, that's where those more qualitative measures are important and could help provide a more holistic picture of school quality.
We'll continue our conversation with LA Unified School District Board Member Kelly Gonez, Kyle Stokes, KPCC Education Reporter, but I really would like to hear from you. If you're a parent of a public school student, either at a charter or district-operated school, if you're a teacher working in a district or a charter school, what do you think about having objective criteria for a rating, a scale that schools would have to help parents decide which schools that their kids would be a best fit for, and also to help the district with allocation of its resources? 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up a little bit later this hour, participation in high school football has declined year after year. We're going to talk about the reasons behind that, what students are doing instead of participating in or going to their high school football games. That's just ahead on Air Talk. Right now, we're talking about LA Unified's efforts to come up with an objective assessment of each of its schools, as well as the charter schools operated within the district, that would give a sense of what their test scores look like, how their test scores are improving over time, would allow also for more transparency as to what the suspension rates are of students attending the school, other criteria. What do you think of that? And what do you think should be the criteria used to make that assessment of the performance of a school? 866-893-KPCC. Michael in Windsor Hills in Southwest LA, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry. I'm a husband to my wife has been a teacher and school leader in charter and public schools. And the point here is about trajectory versus absolute test scores. She's been a part of a number of turnaround efforts. And what we've noticed is that trajectory is always higher at very low performing schools. And that trajectory is not necessarily guaranteed, especially with high school leader and teacher turnover at those schools. So I have the feeling that trajectory is not nearly as important as the absolute score. And as a parent to be, I would be looking at absolute scores rather than trajectory.
So the trajectory, if I'm understanding you, you'd have a year potentially where you'd show very high growth in test scores, and so then your kids would enter the school sort of, you bet that trajectory would continue, but there's no guarantee of it because of turnover.
Exactly. And so, for instance, at one school she taught at, they had a growth of 94 API points, which is a huge amount of growth, but the absolute score was very low. The next year, they had turnovers of principals and key leadership, and the API trajectory, it's very hard to get 94 points of trajectory 2 years in a row, but also that trajectory, I'm not exactly sure what the exact score increase was, but it wasn't nearly as high.
All right. I appreciate it, Michael. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. LAUSD board member Kelly Gomez, you want to talk about why trajectory is given a higher percentage of prominence in the rating system than current test scores?
I'd be happy to. And I think the way I would describe this is focusing on student growth and student progress. What we know is that historically, when we are just looking at absolute achievement at test scores, that can often be skewed by the opportunity gaps that we know that low-income students often face, whether that's disparate access to early childhood education, trauma that they may experience living at home in their communities, et cetera, and isn't really a fair measure of the quality of schools. That's why I think that growth is a much fairer way of assessing school quality, because we're looking at from whatever starting point they're at, how are students progressing at a particular school? Simply looking at absolute test scores is biased and will give credit to schools where students are already coming in at a high level, which might not be attributed to anything that's happening at a particular school, but is simply a fact of the specific population that a school is serving. I have an example of a school in my district where historically, they have been labeled as a failing school, but they are receiving students who are coming in several grade levels behind. And those students are actually growing at a much faster rate than we see at other schools. Their kids are growing one reading level in 6 months versus the traditional trajectory, which is more like one grade level per year. That kind of school should get credit for and should be celebrated for the progress that they're making rather than being denigrated as they have been in the past.
And do those sorts of upward trends, do they typically continue over longer term to where you see those schools catching up with schools that have less challenged student bodies?
Yeah, I think we certainly have examples of that. And I think that sort of growth mindset is what we want to encourage to happen more broadly throughout the district.
Alicia in Echo Park says, I'm a teacher at a private high school, but used to be a public school teacher in San Francisco. I think it would be better to measure students' sense of well-being directly related to how students are treated at the school. It's a much better measure of a school. That sort of gets to the, you know, kind of subjective analysis I was talking about with feedback from students and parents. That, for me, would be significant as a parent looking at a school as to, you know, how those that are there feel about the experience. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Kyle, we were hearing from Ms. Gomez about how this can be used to allocate resources to schools that are not rated as highly, that have greater challenges. Is there a potential downside to that?
Yeah, the sort of, and to, you know, obviously take as a given that Board Member Gomez is saying we don't want to create a system that is punitive. In the past, when I started my education reporting career, I started it in Indiana, and they created an A through F grading scale for schools, and the schools that got Fs, you can say give extra resources to. Well, what they did in Indiana was they gave extra resources, and then if it didn't cause a change, then that school was taken over by the state or had some other drastic intervention. And I think a lot of people, you know, in Indiana would make the argument that that was not what those schools needed. What those schools needed was sustained support, more funding, and things like that. The other instructive experience that I have from covering the school rating system that is, you know, in Indiana was that there was a similar effort to emphasize the weighting of growth measures. And the state education officials in Indiana, actually, there was a school that they sort of used as the avatar and said, this is what we want all schools in the state to look like. Well, they put a growth measure into the A through F grading scale there. Again, not what's being proposed in LAUSD, but what they had in Indiana at the time. And when the state of Indiana tried to measure growth, that school got a C. And they were like, whoa, that's not what we want at all. We like this school. We want them to get an A. And so they fiddled with the sort of tinkered under the hood of the rating scale, and they ended up getting an A. So I think, I'm sort of flagging here some of the concerns that have been raised here before is that, you know, there are, you know, on one hand, you don't want to continue to, you know, credit schools who are going to get 94% of their kids passing tests, you know, into perpetuity. You don't want to design a rating system that does that. That doesn't do anything for a school district like LAUSD. On the other hand, how you measure growth, it, you know, these little very, very fine statistical, technical changes can have a big change in how these ratings turn out. And then it raises the question, is it fair to compare one school's rating to another?
We reached out to the Charter School Association here in California, and they were not able to join us in the conversation. But Kelly Gonez, LAUSD school board member, have the charters weighed in on this at all? Are they represented in this process, and have they expressed any concerns about having a rating attached to their campuses?
Well, I think they were included as part of that working group that I alluded to before that met many times last year to get their feedback, because obviously there are particular issues related to charter schools and their renewals that those details need to be thought through. I haven't consulted with them, so I don't know if they have particular concerns. I think that there is a question about to what extent the school performance framework could factor into renewals in future years. Right now, when we look at a charter school that is up for renewal every 5 years, we just look at absolute test scores as compared to resident schools, so schools in that local neighborhood. And I think there's often been discussion at the board about how the fact that that's not really a high standard of success, because you could have a neighborhood school where 8% of kids are meeting and exceeding the standard in math. And at the charter school, 9% of the kids are meeting and exceeding in math, and that charter school is renewed. For my colleagues, I've heard that that doesn't really feel like a super successful school. And so I think that this has the potential to be a more ambitious measure of success for those schools. But of course, we have to think through the implementation of that, as well as how that aligns with the legal requirements that are set by the state.
Stephen North Hollywood says, I work with charter schools. Charters are already evaluated by LA Unified on a 4-point rubric, both on a financial and academic level. I think it's about time LAUSD evaluates its district-run schools on the same level. My question is, who will be evaluating? Will it be objective and independent? Ms. Gonez?
So the framework, like I said, was some guiding posts were laid out in a resolution passed by the board a year and a half ago now. But this diverse working group were the ones who laid out the specifics, and ultimately it will fall under the superintendent's shop to administer. But it is one uniform framework for all schools, and so there isn't an evaluator per se. It is a framework that has been developed that will be applied consistently to all schools, including independent charter schools.
Evelyn in Reseda says, I'm a parent of a 10th grader attending an LA Unified school, and I would love to see this growth over time metric. It would help my child, and it would help me see how the school is doing overall. Evelyn, I appreciate that very much. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Brian comments on the AirTalk Facebook page. It's awful. With the exception of some high-performing charter schools, you can pretty much tie a school's ranking to the average household income of its students. There always has been and always will be a direct correlation between the two. Rankings only help give higher socioeconomic schools another feather in their cap. That's Brian commenting on the Facebook page for AirTalk.
That's absolutely a rub here. With all test scores, and I think that it does go to a challenge here. I mean, you want to create a system to prioritize as a school administrator where resources go. On the other hand, the question is how punitive do they become, and can you compare the ratings of one school to another? That's obviously, you know, what the intention is of this here. It's very, very hard to do this and do it with sensitivity.
All right, Kyle Stokes, KPCC Education Reporter. Thank you for joining us to talk talking about this story, Howard Bloom in the LA Times, writing about LA Unified coming up with its rating system for district operated as well as charter schools within LA Unified. And our thanks to LA School Board member Kelly Gomez as well. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, the decline of high school participation in football. What are the factors behind it? Have we already reached peak football? What does it mean for other sports as well? We'll hear on that right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us, and hope you'll stick around for the second hour because we're going to spend the entirety of it with the CEO of LA Metro, Phil Washington. We've got so much to talk about in public transit. We'll take your calls, and I've got 2 pages worth of subject areas to talk with Phil about. We got a lot to discuss. That's next hour, Air Talk, here on KPCC. Couple of weeks ago, I was reading Los Angeles Times prep sports columnist Eric Sondheimer's article about the decline in California high school football participation. This is a trend that's been seen over the last few years. In Eric's piece, he quotes California Interscholastic Federation, the CIF, showing that there's a drop of 3% in high school football participation last fall. And this has been part, as I said, of a steadily dropping participation trend. Eric Sondheimer joining us to talk about it. Eric, good morning.
Good morning to you.
So how long has this decline been taking place?
This is 4 consecutive years, and a total of more than 12,000 students are missing and no longer playing football. And what's interesting is the participation level overall has continued to go up every year. So where do those students disappear to? Obviously, I think they're playing other sports. And so that should put out an alarm bell for people that love football that, yes, it remains very popular as a fan sport to watch, but less young people are playing it, and that's a concern.
Well, and I've just heard anecdotally that even attendance at high school games, and obviously it varies school by school, football is still really big at you know, many campuses, but that it's not necessarily the big unifying social event that high school football attendance used to be. You go on cover games. What have you seen?
Yes, for sure that there has been a decline. The Southern Section, which is the largest section in California, has seen a decline in attendance for its playoff events in a lot of different sports for the last 4 years. But there's also been decline in other events, whether it's college or pro too. So that could be, and particularly in California, we have traffic issues. And I think that's one of the issues that has been coming up. Also, more games are being screened, whether it's on television or through the streaming process. So there's more opportunities for people to watch games by not being there. And there's also definitely other things to do in Southern California. So you're competing against all these different things. And that's what this whole situation comes down to, is people better start taking this very seriously because there are some issues that are developing.
Eric Sondheimer, Los Angeles Times prep sports columnist, who's been covering prep sports for 22 years at the Times. Eric, you went out and you talked to some coaches and players to get a sense of what's going on. What do they cite as the biggest reasons for the participation decline?
Certainly parents. The players say their parents are scared. They don't want them to play football. They feel it's a safety issue. Coaches feel like parents are concerned about that, but I have to give credit to football. They have done a great job at addressing that issue. The proper concussion protocols are much stronger. If you get hurt in a high school game, you're out a minimum of 7 days with a concussion just for without even talking to the doctor. You have to get it cleared. Also, they've been improving on tackling techniques. There's far less hitting going on at practices. That's a new statewide rule. Used to be 90 minutes. I believe now it's going to be 60 minutes. So they're addressing that, but the perception among parents has to be changed. And that's what needs to be done, because even though it is improved safety-wise, it needs to get to the parents to do that. Also, it involves multi-sport athletes. There's been a drop in that, and people are specializing, and you have to choose between a sport that you're good at and a sport you just want to participate in. They're choosing the sport that they're good at, and so a lot of those two-sport athletes are not playing football anymore, the periphery athlete, so the rosters are dwindling a little bit. Now, people think it will stabilize. I do eventually think it will stabilize, but I don't think it's going to definitely go up for any time soon either.
I'd love to hear from AirTalk listeners about the decline in high school football participation. And if you're a parent of a student who is considering playing high school football or is currently playing or recently played high school football, what's your sense of what's going on and why football, despite the fact it is by far the most popular spectator sport in America, selling out the largest stadiums, by far the highest rated televised sport, but when it comes to high school participation, what has been historically and still is the biggest sport in terms of high school participation, nonetheless, you see the downward trend. What do you think is going on? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also joining us is the regional director for Pop Warner Football Westcon Region, Paul Watkins. There are 13 member leagues across Southern California, Southern Nevada, Arizona, and Hawaii. Mr. Watkins, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
I know that Pop Warner has instituted a number of safety measures to try and deal with parental concerns about participation in tackle football. But what are you seeing in terms of, you know, participation numbers? Are you down?
We were down for several years, but we've balanced out now. We're starting to see some upward trends in different areas. We've made some changes, and we've added some different levels of football, and I think that has helped us. Try to bring our balance back up. We used to strictly offer strictly weight based football. That was pretty much what we did, and this year we are bringing in unweighted football in certain groups. So that's the first time for us. So we're kind of incorporating that in our program, along with the other changes that we made over probably the last 4 or 5 years ago. And one of the first that we made was to limit the amount of contact that you can have in practices. So, you know, we went down, we limited it to 45 minutes probably for 3 or 4 years ago. So we kind of saw that on the horizon. Along with, we have eliminated kickoffs. We started with our smaller leagues, and we've added the Pee Wee League this year. So only one of our divisions still will have kickoffs. So we've tried to do that to eliminate some of the head impacts. And this year, our three lower divisions are going to a 2-point stance, again with the emphasis of, you know, keeping your head up, trying to avoid some more of those contacts and make the game a little bit safer.
Does Pop Warner require that each of your leagues track concussions either in league games or in practices? Is that all counted?
We do track that. We've probably done that for the last 5 years. If a child is hurt in a practice, we just recognize as a head injury, we'll just bring the child off the field. We have different, some of our organizations have baseline testing that they do with their kids ahead of time. It's a field test that they can use. and they'll go directly to that and take a look. And if there's any difference in the numbers and when they pre-tested and when they take the test when a child was hit, then the child will come off the field until he goes to see his doctor and he gets his release and so he's able to participate again.
But you're able to track if concussions are on the decline or head injuries are on the decline or whether they're increasing?
No, they've decreased.
Okay, so you do track. All right. We're talking with Paul Watkins, Pop Warner Football, WestCon Region. He's regional director. Coming up, we'll talk with University of Colorado Director of the Sports Governance Center, Roger Pelkey, who has a new research paper that looks at football participation across the country, attendance, takes a look at what the state of football in America is. Again, if you're a parent, if you... have a student who's playing football now at the high school level, recently played it, or a child who wants to play it. How are you weighing in on that? 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. We'll be back in just 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle, we're taking a look at the state of high school football in California, where we've seen in recent years a decline in participation. What are the reasons for that? Are students going to other sports in lieu of football? Are they playing video games instead? What's happening? With us is Roger Pelkey of University of Colorado Sports Governance Center that he directs. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, do we see generally students going who might have historically been football players now going into other sports or even into video games instead of football?
So the first thing to understand as we have this discussion is football remains the king of sports. There's still more than a million high school boys who play football. And in second place is track and field with 600,000. So football has seen a decline, but it's not a crisis and it's not going away anytime soon. In the context of football declining, overall sports participation has gone up. So boys are choosing to either play other sports or the increasing number of boys coming in are choosing not to play football. But it's undeniable that the football has seen a peak and is going back down.
All right. And since overall sports participation is going up, we're not seeing esports take over actual physical sports activity.
Not yet. There has not been a cut into overall sports participation, which is good for the health of our youth, I guess.
What about attendance at high school games? I know in some parts of the country, high school football is still a central social event. And I wonder what you see in the longer term trend there.
Yeah, the data on attendance at high school games is really sketchy. And not universally collected, certainly not with consistent methods. I will say that the decline in football participation has been observed over the recent years in about 40 states. There's still about 10 states where there has been an increase. Of interest at the college level, where the NCAA keeps really good statistics, there has been a notable decline in people attending in stadium games, which has athletic directors scratching their heads and wondering how to get people back.
So you said by far football is still the king. We certainly know from television ratings that football is still the behemoth. But do you think that we've reached peak football, so to speak? Is there any growth room in football remaining?
If you look across various metrics, everything from Pop Warner, Pee Wee football participation to high school participation to college attendance to TV viewership for the NFL. Almost all these indicators suggest that football has peaked and is going in the other direction. We could discuss why that is, even as it remains the nation's most popular sport, certainly on TV. And of course, the NFL is insulated from these effects because it is a very small league with about 5,000 players. It's national. It's on TV. It's regularly the top 10 TV broadcast viewership every year are NFL games. So I think we're going to see the effects more at the youth level, in the community level, and unevenly across the United States.
Michael, in Eagle Rock, you're a high school teacher, I understand. What do you see in terms of football participation?
Well, I've been teaching for 12 years, and I've seen a lot of kids come into my room with head injuries. And I find it interesting that when we're discussing the change of the sport, the focus is on how to respond to head injuries. And I understand that there's been a lot of work into preventing them, but it's sort of fundamental to the sport that your head will get injured. And personally, I've seen a lot of my students really struggle. The effects of concussions are very long-lasting. I had a kid last year who got a concussion in soccer and was continually being pushed, even in her gym class, even though she had doctor's notes, to participate in activities where there would be lasting impacts on her ability to cognitively function. She ended up having to go onto a 504 plan, despite being a very high-performing student and really struggling with the idea of labeling herself, just to get her instructors to recognize that the concussion was a lasting, serious cognitive issue. I understand football is a cultural touchstone, but I honestly kind of am hoping that the culture is pushing kids away from football, because there are a lot of opportunities to build the same qualities that a lot of folks who are very committed to the sport see: teamwork, grit, determination, health. Mm. And there are so many different activities that kids can get involved in. Think of climbing, where there's very little risk to their long-term ability to think. I think it's really about the experiences we want our kids to have and who we'd like them to become. And more, their lasting success depends on their ability to think and to be confident, clever folks. And the potential impact from even one concussion can be very severe.
Michael, I appreciate that. Michael, high school teacher, joining us from Eagle Rock. Let me go back to Eric Sondheimer, LA Times prep sports columnist. Eric, you feel comfortable making the case for football despite the risk of head injuries?
I believe it is safer than it's ever been. It's as the caller said, it's part of the fabric. But it's not for everybody. It's tough. It's become tougher. You have to train year-round now at the high school level to participate. And I definitely think the season is too long, but I don't think that's going to change. I think it's a good sport for people to have mentorships. I talked to a college coach the other day, Gary Bernardi. He's been coaching for many years at six different schools. He said he got involved in sports, high school football, or met his future high school coach when he was 12 years old. And at 85, his high school coach is now 85, and he still talks to him. And he says every major decision he goes through the high school coach. So you would be missing out on those mentorships. Yes, you can get them in other areas, but football has been known to really be good at training and helping people mature and grow up. So I certainly hope that parents don't lose out on that. Those missions that they can still get through football.
Roger Pelkey, University of Colorado. I wonder about, Eric brought this up, single sport athletes, where you used to have some of the most gifted high school athletes would do a couple of sports, sometimes even more. And can we quantify that? Is single sport now dominating?
Yeah, the Aspen Institute has a great program looking at youth sports. And that is an issue across sports. There are a lot of pressures, as we just heard, for athletes, whether they're in basketball or soccer or even volleyball or football, to be all year round in one sport. And that's going to create additional pressures. Football folks I talk to are hopeful that flag football at the youth level will fill in for tackle football. But I think that's a questionable, because it's unlikely that a kid who's 15, 16 years old will say, OK, all of a sudden I want to put on pads and a helmet. It's more likely that you'll see parents and kids petitioning high schools to make flag football a varsity sport in the future.
Roger Pelkey, thanks so much. University of Colorado. He directs its Sports Governance Center. Paul Watkins of Pop Warner Football, regional director for the Western U.S. And my thanks to prep sports columnist for the Los Angeles Times, Eric Sondheimer, for 22 years. He's been doing a terrific job of covering high school sports here in Southern California. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Much more to come. morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Got so much to talk about in public transit over the course of this hour. LA Metro CEO Phil Washington is with us in studio. He'll take your questions, whether it's light rail, bus lines, the many planning projects that LA Metro is in the midst of. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Phil, good to have you with us again.
It's great to be here, Larry. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with one of the biggest projects, the Next Gen Bus Study. This to take a look at a revamp of how best to serve bus customers, where LA Metro, like other urban bus districts, are seeing a decline in people using buses. Where do we stand in that project?
Yes, thank you for the question. Our service planners have been very, very busy over the last year digging through ridership data, regional tap data, cell phone based data to understand where and when Angelenos move around the county. And so we've gotten the blessing from our board on the regional service concepts, which really provides a blueprint for our line by line improvements to begin taking shape. And so the idea is to look at all of the service that we have on the street today. We're looking to speed up the service. I think that is one of the biggest things. And we're also looking to provide frequent service throughout the day, even in the midday. So this is a huge effort. It has not been done in about 25 years at Metro, where we have wiped the slate clean, if you will, to look at all the service. We know that there's new employment centers. We know that there's new residential centers. And so we believe that this next gen study, as we begin to trot out the new service and new routes and all those things on the street, will make for a very, very efficient bus system as we move forward.
Now, it looks like the public meetings, you've gone through that process. So what's the next step towards adoption of the plan?
In September, we're going to bring to our board sort of the lines on the map, if you will, for bus routes. And we will brief our board on what those lines mean. We will talk about ridership data. We will talk about everything that's on that map. We will get input again from our board. And then later on this year, we will begin the implementation process, which probably will take us about 5 or 6 months to actually get that new service on the street.
And will there be additional funding for bus travel specifically as a part of the Next Gen initiative?
Yes. I mean, you know, right now we have the bulk of our service, the bulk of our budget is in operations right now, and that is bus and rail. 75% of our riders are on the bus. A lot of people think it's all on rail, but 75% are on bus. We will look at our budget for that. We have not said what the budget will be for Next Gen. We just are wanting to be very efficient with whatever service we put on the street.
One of the issues that's been raised about the decline in bus ridership is the cost of housing in Los Angeles County. And being that, you know, bus riders have a lower median income than rail riders, the thought is that perhaps the bus rider customer base has eroded. People have moved out of the area because they just can't afford the rents to stay in the area served by Metro buses. There's also the issue, and you've raised this before, that buses can only go as fast as the traffic around them if there's really no advantage to the bus. And if used cars are relatively cheap, then why does someone ride the bus? So how do you think that we've seen a fundamental shift that's going to long-term impact bus ridership?
Well, a couple of things I would point to on the ridership front. I mean, it's easy to write an article that says, hey, bus ridership is hemorrhaging and, you know, all those kinds of things without looking at some of the underlying reasons for it. You mentioned some of the reasons. I mean, we've had affordable housing is a big issue where people are being pushed further and further away from the urban core. And we have to put bus service or rail service out there to satisfy this. So I think there's a lot of different issues that tie in to the ridership declines. It's a national phenomena, actually, that's happening all over the country. So some of the things that we're doing, in addition to the next gen that I just talked about, that's going to make bus service more efficient and more reliable, I think looking at some of our ideas on congestion pricing, which I hope we will talk about a little bit later, and looking at enhancing the customer experience, I think that we have to adopt sort of a carrot and a stick approach to the ridership issue that ties to climate change and ties to all these things. And the carrot is the many projects that we're building right now. The stick is changing behavior through congestion pricing.
Charging people to go into areas of high congestion.
That's exactly right. And we have also presented the idea of the revenues from congestion pricing making transit free all over this county. So these are bold and aggressive moves that we're making, but I think it will address the ridership issue. But people's behavior has to change in order for us to regain that ridership in many respects.
Does that mean you think that through congestion pricing, it could alleviate congestion enough that people would get an advantage to taking buses, that you would lure people who otherwise could afford a car to use public transit?
We think so. We think so. Now, this is coupled with things like bus-only lanes. This is coupled with express service. All of these things are interconnected, but I believe that with a nicely structured congestion relief effort that we have presented to our board, and we in a feasibility study stage right now with that congestion pricing, I think people will see our buses and our trains as viable alternatives, and that leads to speeding up the system because there will be less traffic out there, and not to mention reducing the carbon footprint.
We're talking with Phil Washington. He's the CEO of L.A. Metro. We're talking about all things public transit in L.A. County, and we're taking your calls, your questions for him at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll get back to bus transit and congestion pricing in a moment, but we have a listener question about the plan to extend the Expo line to the Santa Monica Terminus on 2nd Street. When is that extension planned to be completed?
Well, right now, no time soon. Right now, the Expo line is really one of our most popular lines. It exceeded the 30-year ridership projections in the first year. We have not looked at extending that line in Santa Monica just yet, but that does not mean we won't do it in the future.
JP writes on the page, can a line be reinstalled running north-south through the South Bay area? Traffic is terrible along PCH, Sepulveda there. Many commuters stay on the west end of the county, i.e. commuting between Redondo Beach and Santa Monica. Any plans to link those communities?
We are looking at a lot of that with the next gen study, linking that in our bus system. And so we're looking at ridership patterns. We're looking at residential concentrations, employment concentrations. That is an area that that is a part of our next gen study, and we'll take a hard look at that.
Johnny posts on the AirTalk Facebook page, I'm a frequent passenger on the Expo line. I find the electronic displays at each station really frustrating. Displaying the date and time is of minimal benefit to passengers. Why can't the display show the time until the next two trains can be expected at each station, just as every other light rail or subway system seems to do throughout the world?
That is exactly what we're working on right now. We are working on a system where you will see exactly when the next train will come. We are, our IT department is hard at work on that now. I think you'll see that in the next 6 to 12 months.
Robin Mid-Wilshire says, any ideas about setting up hygiene centers within metro stations for the homeless population, having mental health professionals coming onto trains? Wasn't there a pilot program, Rob, at some point for those kinds of interventions with the homeless population?
Well, actually, we have our teams on the system right now. We have eight teams of five. They include a mental health specialist, a former homeless person who's now a professional, social workers. So we have folks on our system now. They're called C3 teams. We have placed, I believe, about 88 homeless people from our trains in housing. One of the challenges that we have is the homeless on our trains. We engage them with these various teams, and we see what we can do professionally to help them. In terms of facilities for showering and those kinds of things, we have talked within our committees, our board committees, and with our board on how we could facilitate that. One of the things that we're doing is some bridge housing at a facility that we had in Venice that we have since vacated. So we are looking at those kinds of things and looking to step into those leadership voids as it relates to homeless.
And hopefully we'll have a chance to get to that issue, too, mm-hmm. of these developmental partnerships that L.A. Metro is involved with in developing these properties that are either underutilized or no longer utilized by L.A. Metro. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Lucille asks, what is being considered for the first mile, last mile issue? Scooter solution seems problematic, Lucille says.
We have a couple of programs to address first and last mile. One is microtransit. The microtransit program that we are beginning to pilot is a program that has vehicles, smaller vehicles, van type vehicles that can be used in an Uber-like service. It's a curb-to-curb service specifically for first and last mile. So that is that microtransit program will be launching in the next few months. We have another program called Mobility on Demand. And so this Mobility on Demand, right now, we're piloting it in three areas of the county. That program, you can call a number. It's free right now, actually. I don't have that number with me, but it's on our website. You can call that number and go anywhere in that pilot area for free. Now, this is probably first of its kind that I know of in the country that we have a free service because it's a pilot service where you can go anywhere in.
Is it a van or what?
It's a van. It's a smaller vehicle. You would share that vehicle with other folks within that pilot area. So I've used that service myself in the El Monte area. And it's running for free right now in those pilot areas.
Do you use your phone or call up to have the pickup? Or?
Yes, there's a phone number that you need to call. Since it's free, you don't need a credit card or anything like that. But we are really looking at addressing these first last mile issues with scooters and, of course, our bike program as well.
Ned in Pasadena wonders about the time frame of all electric buses. How soon would we see Metro be zero CO2 emissions?
Our board has directed me to come up with a plan to electrify our entire bus fleet by 2030. We are in the process of doing that right now. We will start with the Orange Line in the San Fernando Valley. That will be all electric. We will start with that. We've got the first bus in actually about 2 weeks ago. So we will have that fleet on the Orange Line all electric in 2020 or so. It's toward the fall of 2020. So we are gradually looking to electrify the whole fleet by 2030 and maybe even the majority of the fleet ready by 2028.
Do you feel like the technology is at such a point on electric buses that it makes financial sense?
Well, right now, you know, we're looking at the technology. We're also looking at the prices as well. And we think as the technology improves, the price will go down. They're very expensive right now. More importantly, though, our facilities, retrofitting our facilities to be able to charge electric buses is probably the bigger issue. And then, of course, training of our employees and that sort of thing. So we are on the way to doing that. We have sort of a roadmap to get us there. One of the challenges is we have buses. We have clean natural gas or CNG buses right now. We have to really retire those buses in such a way that we do not waste them, if you will. And so we're doing this sort of a shell game, if you will, to make sure that we have enough CNG buses as the electric technology takes hold.
And I would think having, you know, your bus yards geographically spaced so that, you know, the buses can be charged, unless you're going to have SEP standalone charging facilities. But then where would you have the bus sitting while it's charged if it's not a transit yard?
Exactly. It'll have to be in those yards, our existing yards right now. And we have 18, 20 yards out there now all over the county. They are strategically placed. The challenge is really getting those ready to charge 200 or 300 buses every night.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a big production.
All right, Ned, good question you asked. We'll continue our conversation with L.A. Metro CEO Phil Washington. We'll talk about the controversy over the rapid bus that's aimed at connecting Pasadena with North Hollywood and the Red Line there. Eagle Rock residents have concerns. We'll talk about that. We'll get back to congestion pricing and what that level would have to be and where the first pilot project might be located. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in just 1 minute. Public transit, our topic, with the CEO of LA Metro, Phil Washington. We're taking your excellent questions at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Really appreciate the range and significance of the questions that we've had so far. Phil, let's talk about rapid bus transportation, because one of the strategies in this part of the Next Gen study is creating more of these designated bus lanes where buses could go faster than the surrounding traffic. That's been controversial in Eagle Rock, which is along the route of this rapid bus proposal from Pasadena to North Hollywood. And how does LA Metro navigate, you know, these concerns of residents that's going to have a negative effect on traffic or even lead to what they see as potential overdevelopment of their neighborhoods?
Very carefully is how we navigate. The North Hollywood Pasadena Bus Rapid Transit, first of all, it's a 267 million 18 mile project to build high quality bus rapid transit line that will connect the San Fernando Valley and the San Gabriel Valleys. Traveling east to west between North Hollywood Station and Pasadena City College, with stops all along the way.
Including Glendale, Burbank.
Glendale, Burbank, Eagle Rock. The goal of this project is to provide a fast and affordable bus line that will service this corridor. There's been a lot of discussion. I was at that Eagle Rock meeting last week, I believe it was. The project is funded by Measure M. We went to the voters in November 2016, and the voters approved, among other things, bus rapid transit countywide. And so we are now in that implementation phase. The issue with regard to Eagle Rock, in many respects, is taking a lane or having a bus only lane on a section of Colorado Boulevard versus using Highway 134. In using Highway 134, we would miss all of the ridership that we would get on Colorado. And so we're in the process now of listening to the community. We are not, we have no authority of land use and those kinds of things. So that is the city. But what I would say, and I said this at the meeting, is this project, whether we end up with bus only lanes or not, I mean, it comes with infrastructure improvements as well. And so and that is part of that project budget of $267 million. It also comes with us mitigating any impacts we would make, any negative impacts we would make. Parking and things like that. So
during construction or long term?
Long term as well. Well, both actually. So we are not looking to just come in and wipe, you know, things out. We have to mitigate the negative effects, both in construction and ongoing. And I think that, you know, we have seen bus only lanes work. When you look at the Dodger Express that we run from Union Station, that is a bus only lane where we go right to the stadium, the Silver Line, bus only lanes. These things work. They are efficient and they are very, very fast. We will continue to listen to the residents. But there's a lot of supporters and there's a lot of opponents.
Yeah, it's definitely split the community. I mean, the challenge is there's a finite amount of traffic space on Colorado Boulevard in Eagle Rock. And so I understand what you're saying about the infrastructure mitigations. But still, you're dealing with, you know, finite amount of real estate there to put cars as well as a rapid bus line through. I want to go back to ask about congestion pricing, because is there a specific area where Metro is prepared to establish a pilot program for charging people to enter either during peak hours or at all times?
Well, right now we are doing a feasibility study. The results of that feasibility study will help identify a pilot area to pilot congestion pricing. So we are in the throes of that right now, that feasibility study, bringing on a consultant to help us identify one, which area is best to pilot the program, and two, what model we should use. I mean, there are three types of congestion pricing models. There is something called the corridor model, which is a quadrant model, which is implemented in London. So that is in the city center. You have a quadrant. You have an area. Any car goes in there. They are charged that amount. That's one model. There is a corridor model that says that the whole corridor would be charged at various times a day. And then there is vehicle miles traveled. So there's three models out there. And so this feasibility study, and with the help of a consultant, will help us identify a pilot area, identify what model of congestion pricing we should use. And we will go into that pilot period in that pilot area. And then, as I said earlier, within that pilot area, we can also pilot the idea of free transit to start off in that pilot area.
And I assume part of that is, aside from the practical considerations, a kind of response to the argument that well-to-do people will just pay the fee and it's no mm-hmm. skin off their nose. But for working class people who don't really have necessarily public transit option to get to the point they need to get to, they bear the brunt of it. So your argument would be, well, if the money's invested in public transit, that will give working class people more options.
Yes. But, you know, also just on the pricing itself, I mean, part of what we need to look at and figure out is the equity piece of this, too, as it relates to charging. We have discount programs right now with our passes and everything. So I think we can handle the equity piece. I think there's an argument, though, to say that the handyman with the truck or whatever that is moving, you know, around the county and doing odd jobs and things like that, who's to say that that individual would not pay a fee to get to the second job quicker?
To tack that then onto the fee they charge the consumer.
Exactly. So there's a lot of things we have to work through. But I think at the end of the day, The question becomes, how do we want to live? We have gridlock now. We have tremendous congestion now. We have another 2.5 million more people coming here in the next 10 or 15 years. How do we want to live? Do we want to sit in traffic drive single occupancy vehicles and that sort of thing? Or do we want free flow of traffic, and do we want free transit, which I think we are going to be coming to?
LA Metro CEO Phil Washington with us. He joins us regularly on Air Talk with us this entire hour. Bong Bong tweets to Air Talk, the popularity of Uber and Lyft illustrate the impossibility of bus or subway lines reaching critical mass. Fixed routes are a costly and blunt instrument to moving masses of people. Subsidization of bus and subway services amounts to the corruption and hiding of the true costs of operation. Taxpayers are on the hook for services, maintenance, and the total cost of salaries and benefits for workers, all huge expenses. That's Bong Bong tweeting at Air Talk. Phil, you want to respond to that?
Yes. Well, Uber and Lyft, fixed route, all of those things. One of the things the UCLA study from about a year ago really pointed out is that while Uber and Lyft impacts ridership, it impacts it sort of a lesser degree versus car ownership. And so the UCLA study really pointed to car ownership as the biggest reason for the decline in ridership, not just here in California, but around the country. And so we are dealing with the car ownership thing and the, you know, sort of the sexy car and, you know, Matthew McConaughey with the hair and all of that. He makes this great pool shot and then he goes and gets into the Navigator. I would like to make a great pool shot like that and then go out and get on a bus.
Yeah.
But the idea also of fixed route, this is the very reason. We know fixed route is a blunt instrument, which is why we are looking at micro transit and we're looking at mobility on demand that I mentioned earlier. So we're trying to hit all bases and really reimagine this county. I was talking to someone just the other day about if we wanted to create a city, if we were looking to create a city, we would probably say that we need to move large amounts. We should move large amounts of people on something like mass transit. If we were building a whole new city and looking at open space and looking at how to move people, that is what we're trying to do here.
I think another point to raise with Bong Bong's tweet that he just made is that the long-term economic models of Uber and Lyft are uncertain, particularly with the state Supreme Court's Dynamex decision, what compensation to drivers is going to be required, what that's going to mean for the fares for ride-hailing companies. So that, you know, we're still very early in this sort of experiment with ride-hailing companies. The other issue is, at least in New York, and I don't know if it's been studied here, ride-hailing companies have contributed significantly to traffic in New York with the cars driving around with just the driver and no fare, no passenger inside the vehicle. So the question is, yes, it's very convenient. At this point, it's affordable to use ride-hailing. Is that going to be true in the long term? And, you know, what's the trade-off in terms of congestion with relying heavily on ride-hailing companies? 866-893-KPECC, the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. The CEO of LA Metro, Phil Washington, with us. Coming up, we're going to talk with Brian in Silver Lake, who has an idea for providing more parking for those who use Metro Light Rail and subway lines. 866-893-KPECC. We'll be continuing right here on 89.3 after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with LA Metro CEO Phil Washington. We're talking about public transit in LA County. Stephen on the Air Talk page writes about concerns about sexual activity at one of the Gold Line stations in Pasadena at Allen Avenue. And just asking Phil about it, he says lighting is going to be increased at the Allen Avenue station there of the Gold Line. So, Stephen, that very direct answer there. to your question. 866-893-KPCC. Brian in Silver Lake, you're on with Phil Washington.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for calling taking my call. I use Metro bus and rail several times a week, and it's always struck me that there's a lot of underutilized parking, not only in parking lots that are established, but also in, you know, maybe lots that are waiting to be developed upon, sometimes go many months or even years empty within reasonable walking distance of rail stations in particular. And I was wondering if it's possible or what's been done, or maybe, you know, how could that space be, or owners be incentivized to provide that for MTA users?
Yeah, it's a big challenge because some of your stations just don't have enough parking.
Yeah, that's true. We are looking at our entire parking program. We have a parking czar that works for Metro that looks at parking and how we can better utilize it. We are doing sort of a parking study right now. You will notice that we have some lots that we are now charging for parking, and up and down the Gold Line and in other places as well. So we are doing a study on that right now to look at how we can work with property owners to lease parking. So you'll see a lot of that. One of the things that I've noticed, though, as we started charging for parking last month or the last couple of months, is there is a lot of available parking in some of the Metro parking lots right now. So we're seeing that that space free up. And our main objective is to manage parking, not so much the revenue generation.
Well, then where are those people going? Because you have to be concerned. Yeah. Does that mean those people aren't riding now because they don't want to pay for parking? Or what alternative method are they using to getting to the station?
Well, we have, one example is some of the parking that was on the Gold Line that's right across the street from 24-Hour Fitness. What we noticed was a lot of people that were working out was using that parking lot. And when we start charging for that, those spaces emptied up. Now those spaces are beginning to fill up again because I think people that could not find parking previously because it was being used by someone else is coming back to the system as well.
L.A. Metro CEO Phil Washington with us. Walter in Highland Park wondering about whether the time will come that people can take their pets on public transit. He'd like to take his dog to the park or to the beach. It would be great if public transit could accommodate it. Someone else had posted that Seattle allows for people to bring their pets on public transit.
Yeah. We will look into the Seattle program. Right now, we just say service animals on public transit. We can definitely look at that. We'll look at Seattle's program and see how it's faring there.
All right. I do want to talk about safety issues because, as always, we have a number of people who raise concerns about safety. I was looking at some of the stats for crimes for last year on public transit in L.A. County. So, you know, what's the good news and what's still concerning to you?
Well, safety and security remains the top priority for us, of course. Our system security, law enforcement, emergency management, we continue to make strides in significant areas. We've seen a 7% decrease in serious crimes on the system from 2017 to 2018. Now, we have a multi-agency law enforcement model that includes LAPD, Long Beach Police, and also the sheriffs. Previously, we just had the sheriffs. So this multi-agency model and our surge strategies that we have been using on the system really have proven to reduce crimes in key areas. And then, as I mentioned earlier, our homeless outreach teams in coordination with our homeless task force is really impacting in a positive way and compassionately addressing the needs of homeless people seeking shelter on our transit system. So we have a decrease in crime. We're constantly vigilant. We have surges with regard to various areas that may be high crime. These are stats that I like to see when we talk about a decrease in crime.
And that good news, of course, you know, probably far more common than actual crimes are negative encounters, whether it's someone yelling profanities at another passenger, altercations that maybe don't end up as, you know, criminal assault, just unpleasant, threatening experiences that people have. And what's the way you keep track of those, you know, sorts of below criminal experiences?
Right. We have a Transit Watch app that people can call Transit Watch and report those, you know, what we're calling low crime kinds of things. We also encourage people to see something, say something. And so people can use that app. People can call our law enforcement number. They can report incidences. I ride the train or the bus every day, and I see some things as well, and I report them as well, or step in to help people as well. So I think that there's plenty of ways to report. We want a pleasant rider experience for all of our riders, especially, you know, females as well. So we will continue to work on that and continue to have a presence on our system, both trains and buses.
L.A. Metro CEO Phil Washington with us. Wanted to get an update on the Sepulveda Pass project, where you're looking at, what is it, three potential subway routes and one which would be an above ground, I don't know what you call it, monorail or whatever it would be. The price tag of that's gone up considerably. You've got some Measure M funds, I believe, you can put toward that.
Yes.
But where do you stand on funding that?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. We are looking at those concepts. We are looking at heavy rail concepts. We are looking at monorail concepts. We fully anticipate the estimates going up for some of these projects. We are looking at steel, copper, concrete, all of these kinds of things impact these projects. We are still in various phases of talking to the public. We want to keep these models or these modes on the table. And so we'll continue to talk. I mean, we've seen prices. People have talked about the estimates that we've put out there. But the disclaimer is that we have not gone through value engineering. We have not gone through ways to bring down that cost and take what I call the proverbial ornaments off the Christmas tree, if you will, in terms of the project. So there's a number of ways that we can bring down the cost of these projects when we get to the point where we decide on what mode, whether it's going to be monorail or heavy rail. So there's a number of ways. One thing I will report is that we are bringing on the private sector. We think this is going to be a public-private partnership where the private sector will bring some private sector equity. Now, obviously, that's not free money. But the way that we have Measure M structured, we can have a payback on the back end of these projects and start getting these projects built, which we are doing right now.
Which would be through tax dollars, because fare collection wouldn't do that.
No. Fare collection would not. I mean, it would help, but it would not solve the gap.
So the last I saw was the projected price tag is near $14 billion for that Sepulveda Pass project.
That was the last estimate that was out there, but I like to look at a range on these projects, and the range is somewhere between 9 and 14 billion, if you will. And so as we look at this project and do the value engineering, look at the ways that we can bring down that cost, we will make this project affordable.
Now, pardon, this off the top of my head, I may be totally off on my numbers, but I thought it was something like $5 billion you've got in Measure M that would go toward that. Is that right?
That was the 2015 estimate. That's
okay.
Correct. There's a little bit more in that now, and we'll continue to find ways to fund it. This the Sepulveda Transit Corridor is really the most important project, definitely in the Western United States and probably the country, rivaling probably the Gateway Project in New York. And so we see this, and I think our board sees this as one just a tremendously important project in this county.
Can you do it by the time of the Olympics?
We're going to sure try. We're going to definitely try. You know, accelerating these projects makes them cheaper as well. And when you look at the Sepulveda Pass project in Measure M, it's not due for completion until 2033. So we are looking to bring that time down, and we actually are bringing that time down with bringing on a private sector person right now.
We'll continue our conversation and talk about the ongoing saga of building the downtown connector, which brings together a number of different light rail and subway lines in downtown Los Angeles. It was supposed to be done by now, but they ran into a number of obstacles. We'll talk about that project as we continue with LA Metro CEO Phil Washington in 1 minute. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. Larry Mantle with LA Metro CEO Phil Washington. I'm a lot of topics in public transit over the course of this hour. One of the biggest projects ongoing downtown Los Angeles, what's called the Regional Connector, which brings together the blue line, the gold line, the red line, everything that now requires you to do a transfer. You could potentially go end to end on those lines. That project's been extended by a year?
Yeah. Right now, we're scheduled for completion in 2022. The regional connector, as you say, Larry, I mean, it's really a game changer with regard to how people can travel around the county. It's about 60% complete right now. It will have three underground stations in the heart of downtown Los Angeles. And as you say, it will really connect everything and provide for a faster rail trip. This project initially was supposed to be completed. I mean, we listed it as being completed in the fall of 21, I think it is. But it was always supposed to be completed actually in 22. We reflected 2021 because we thought we had some float and we were being optimistic that it could be done toward the end of 21. But that spring of 22 date was always there. So we're on track to finish that. The project is going beautifully. We just last week knocked out one of the panels that will have the connections to the blue line and the expo line. So it's going well. And if you ever want to come down in the hole, let me know. I'll take you down there.
All right. Sounds good. So this, again, person, once this is finished, could get on in Long Beach, downtown Long Beach, and go continuously to Azusa on a single train?
Pretty much. I mean, this is one seat rides practically all over the county. And that's what makes it a game changer, I think. And I think people will utilize this this particular line, and I know I will. It really is going to be a game changer.
One of the challenges that I know you're having is diversifying and attracting younger people into transportation,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Particularly we're at such a low unemployment rate that everybody's competing for employees at this point. So what are the ways that you're trying to get people interested in a career in transit?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because the transit infrastructure industry, one of my big concerns is the lack of a qualified workforce. I mean, we have all of these projects. We have the need to build new infrastructure, which is what we're doing. And there is a need to rebuild the existing infrastructure, which is kind of what we're doing on the blue line from Long Beach. But this idea or this challenge of not having a qualified workforce as we move forward to build these projects is a real concern. 40% of Metro's employees are at retirement age right now. 70% are over the age of 40. And so We have taken it upon ourselves to look to see how we can build a career pathway from cradle to grave, really, in the transportation infrastructure industry. The cradle being a school that we are partnering with the county on, a transportation school that we're building in East or South Los Angeles. This school will break ground in the spring of next year. It will be 9 to 12, ninth graders to 12th graders. It will be a boarding school concept. It will focus on kids in the foster care system. It will focus on low-income kids and teach them the trade, the transportation infrastructure trade. It is an incredible endeavor that we've partnered with the county on. That is the cradle. And then we have a pathway all the way through the transportation infrastructure industry, with the grave being, of course, the CEO position.
And I don't know about calling that the grave, but is the idea as well that maintenance workers would be trained, so people working on those all-electric buses or mechanics and people would also be part of this?
Absolutely. We have we are in the process of building the curriculum with the help of the contractor that we have that's going to be operating the school. And the maintenance and the state of good repair will all be included in that. And not just to supply Metro, but also we're partnering with Water, DWP. We are partnering with the airport. They will draw young people from this school. At the end of the day, when all the grades are in, we'll have 450 kids in this school.
All right. And finally, as we close, I know that LA Metro is looking at partnering with private developers on Metro-owned surplus land for additional housing. Where do those partnerships stand?
Very, very good. We have identified about 15 different pilot or demonstration areas for this joint development. We have said that a portion of it must be affordable housing. Across the portfolio, we have a goal of 35%. I think we had like 39% in terms of the affordable housing that is planned for these developments. And we are really looking at this as a transit-oriented community approach instead of just a TOD or transit-oriented development approach. The idea of a transit-oriented community says that we're looking at everything as it relates to a community.
And, of course, gentrification, big concern with developments like this, that
huge.
Only well-to-do people are going to move into these nice new buildings.
That's right. Well, we are doing our part to avoid displacement and gentrification. The affordability housing issue is a big part of that.
Phil Washington, a pleasure. Thanks. I hope we'll talk again soon.
Absolutely.
Have you back on the show. He's the CEO of LA Metro, Phil Washington. Appreciate all your terrific questions that you've asked over the course of this hour as well. Fresh Air coming up next here on 89.3 KPCC, and I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk here on 89.3.